Okay, I'm on the phone with Brian Taylor up in Toronto. I'm Bob Dobbs in Maui, and it is February 23rd, 2017, and we're discussing the Marshall McLuhan Facebook forum. Now, recently, Brian and I were removed from the list, so we are not allowed to post directly, but we would like to continue to react to what is posted. And I'm looking forward to being able to talk about McLuhan without any restrictions and apply to my new knowledge that I've acquired over the last 8 years. So this is the way I talk about McLuhan, the way I'm going to go into it, with friends or with my own Facebook page without any limitations of what scholars, McLuhan scholars, are supposed to do. So, Brian, just after we were removed on February 9th, 2017, Blake Victor posted this statement: "The everywhere evident desperate nostalgia on the part of an obsolete intellectual elite," elite in quotes, "a nostalgia for the print era's relative stability of authority, makes for very poor media ecology." So a nostalgia for what McLuhan would call the POBs, the print-oriented bastards, preferred medium, makes for very poor media ecology. Now, what is the thread that that's part of? Do you have the topic?
No, I don't have the topic.
Right, so we don't know. It might have been the Neil Postman thread, the value of Neil Postman. So I totally agree with that. And now what's interesting is that Alexander Kouskis responds by saying, "Horse manure, Blake." Then he goes into his life in the computer business. But one of our objections was that Alexander Kouskis, the manager of the list, the administrator of the list, was able to insult people, and we weren't allowed to insult back. And I didn't mind not insulting back, just trying to stay on the topic or deal with the topic. But I don't see why Alex has to call Blake horse manure. But we're not dwelling on that, those aspects. We're going to deal with the discussion itself. That's problem. Go ahead, Brian.
Here. Although, yeah, I mean, that is important, and it's also the way that his response begins with horse manure, but ends with don't post about what you seem to nothing about. I presume you mean the word "no" should have been in there. I assume it's don't post about what you seem to know nothing about. But the word "no" is missing.
Yeah.
And it just, that to me seems just as inappropriate as saying horse manure, that like you're supposed to, you know, everyone is free to respond with correcting and updating and disagreeing with everybody, and he's offering his perception, and it's certainly not a widespread perception. It's certainly worth discussing. So it just seems a strange unexamined assumption that it's not really inappropriate to say don't post about something that you seem to know nothing about.
Yes.
That's kind of a recipe for useless dialogue in general.
And I was accused of being abrupt and disrespectful of other scholars, like I would disagree with Paul Levinson on his hot, cool use applied to McLuhan, to Trump. Said a few other people were wrong, and I'd give some quotes to back myself up. That's saying someone wrong is not as disrespectful as saying horse manure. And I never said someone didn't, I didn't say that they didn't know what they were talking about. I would never say that to somebody. That's a silly statement. You don't know what you're talking about. I try to counter with what they've posted and add some stuff, some quotes that maybe Paul Levinson or Logan didn't know about. So the tone, from my perspective, was ridiculous, that Alex was needlessly aggressive and contradicting the standards that he thought we should apply to a group of scholars. Now, the amazing thing is that 99% of those scholars never posted, There were 1,400 mm-hmm. members approximately when I came on 6-8 months ago, and they weren't involved with this thing. And
there was conflicting hearsay about why they weren't involved. People, we heard that people were not posting because they were intimidated by you and your brusqueness, and we also heard that there are people who agree with things you say but are intimidated to post that, or they don't want to publicly post that.
Yeah,
which is also understandable.
Yeah, people privately supported me.
Brusqueness and insult from the other side, too.
Yeah, people, I didn't know most of them. They would email me, say, I like what you're saying, Bob. It's interesting, but I can't afford professionally to be seen to agree with you, which is crazy that these guys have to be so timid of each other, but that seems to be the nature of academia. It's a tenuous profession subject to all kinds of disruptions, so it tends to be a kind of cowardice. But anyway, in the old tradition, humanist traditions of freedom of speech. But this is what McLuhan predicted, the group mind, the hive mind, the political correctness. So this should be discussed in terms of what McLuhan predicted.
It's certainly an appropriate topic for discussion. And the especially funny thing is that even with that insulting opening and dismissive finish, Alexander Kuskis doesn't really seem to disagree. Like they don't seem to actually respond to what is being said, either in terms of they seem to only respond to the very first part of the mere suggestion of an obsolete intellectual elite.
Yeah.
And the nostalgia, responding to the idea of the nostalgia. And even there, they often these responses seem to be exhibiting or agreeing almost rather than disagreeing. But then they totally ignore the part about the emphasis on the what the nostalgia is for is the relative stability of authority. I mean, he's not saying that like there's no such thing as any authority or any knowledge anymore, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's kind of a specific thing. Like, what he says the nostalgia is for is a relative stability of authority, and no one addresses this question of whether or not it's good media ecology. They're just defensive on the question of the nostalgia and the obsolete elite.
Right. I have a long essay done about 2002 on the six schools of media ecology, and the fourth school I called the diasporic school, and I lumped in Derek de Kirchhoff, Bob Logan, Bruce Powell, William Merwin Thompson, Neil Postman, and maybe one or two other people. Basically, the diasporic, they are lone individuals in their universities, in their scenes, fighting the good fight on behalf of McLuhan, but they tend to be trying to retrieve humanist literate values, knowing full well of their obsolescence, as McLuhan pointed out, but still trying to retrieve. It's almost like retrieve the educational function, being a teacher. And
right.
So a lot of the McLuhan scene that comes out of the Media Ecology Association and some of the Toronto people, there's a great respect for Neil Postman. And it's for what I call the diasporic attitude. I see, personally, Postman is a drag. And Don Thiel, he would hear Postman being interviewed on CBC and be a bit outraged that they didn't interview him. But he said that Postman was an intellectual thug. Now, I don't know about that part, but that's how disgusted Don Thiel was with Neil Postman. And I respect Don Thiel's ability to handle McLuhan and media ecology, so I consider his statement as not foolishness. But without bashing Neil Postman and getting into that, there seems to be a major literate nostalgia that Blake is calling. Because when McLuhan is talking about there can't be Christianity anymore, because it was based on the phonetic alphabet, and maybe the printing press, the Protestant version anyways, and that print environment is not what McLuhan called constitutive anymore. It doesn't mold anybody. Then there is no role for the book dealing with this new environment. And I find that the teachers of a university education, maybe even high school, over the last 50 years cannot get beyond the inadequacy of their role as teachers of literate education. They do not take the more extreme part of McLuhan, what to them would be more extreme, and apply it. But I see McLuhan in his extreme statements as more appropriate, more accurate about what was coming and about what he was up against. What do you think of that?
I mean, I absolutely agree. I would be more inclined to say nice things about Postman and nicer ones about Don Thiel, but I basically agree. I mean, it seems quite evident to me, I guess, but it's also, it's certainly not surprising that this issue would come up around this election, and it is, you know, to the extent that any such thing is important or crucial, it is pretty crucial to try to, the fight over the Postman wisdom and who represents it or who benefits from it or who is the enemy of it, that kind of thing. I mean, this is a potent and important argument, and it clearly is about this nostalgia. I mean, the thing is, nostalgia, I guess it's a loaded term. No one wants to be accused of being nostalgic, but it's unfortunate because I would much prefer to hear all these people say, like, you're darn right I'm nostalgic for it.
Yeah.
And argue for the utility of it from that perspective rather than saying, as, you know, Alex Kuskis says, I have no nostalgia whatsoever for the print era. And it's like, well, okay, I mean, what are you talking about, hundreds of years ago, or what Blake said was the relative stability of authority of that era, and that seems to be something that the loss of that seems to be something they've all specifically bemoaned in the name of Postman even or something many times. Like, the nostalgia is, I mean, it's just odd that he would describe his early adoption of computers.
Here, let me read that. So he says, Horace Manure Blake, I was an early adopter to computers, getting my first in 1983. This is Alexander Kuskis. I was also an early adopter of the Internet and on it in 1992 before it became a publicly accessible medium. I teach graduate courses online and have done so for over a decade. Although I love literature, which I studied and taught the conventional way, I have no nostalgia whatsoever for the print era and have advocated education reform to make it relevant for the digital era. Half my career has been in communication industries, first book publishing and then the computer industry and IT training, and many academics have similar interests in new media. Don't post about what you seem to know nothing about. His biography is irrelevant. His experience is irrelevant. One of McLuhan's main points is we're all deaf, dumb, and blind before the new media effect. So to start citing one's personal, professional, efficient causality expertise is always anti what McLuhan's pointing out.
And that, and I just don't see the connection to what Blake was talking about at all. Like, he says a desperate nostalgia, but he doesn't say, like, a anti-digital purism or something.
Right.
Like, just because people are enthusiastic early adopters of new technology doesn't mean that their sensibility is not still literate, and it's appearing as a tantalizing, interesting figure on that ground of what they, and, you know, the things that they're going to see as potentials in it are, I'm sure, quite literate biased in terms of communication of text. You know, it's like, yay, we had this electric and electronic media that was totally acoustic and swamp-like, and now we've got something that's more retrieving and emphasizing the letters and, you know, discrete alphabet segments being sent. This is fantastic. You know, that, I mean, I feel the same way. It's just like, it all comes down to this, like, you really do have to take that advice about getting the moral praise or blame out of everything, or that it's, like, not everything is a denunciation or an endorsement.
Right. Okay, so it seems to be, as you say this, that there's a a battle here between the value of education. So when Alex is talking about this is a space, a forum for scholars, sounds like he means people who write books, and it's applicable to university and education. They do not question the role of education. They still think there's a little bit left for it. Now, McLuhan used to advocate, and so I'm going to quote McLuhan just so people know what he said. I'm not necessarily agreeing with McLuhan or promoting him, but it's always interesting to know what McLuhan said. So he told the administrators of education to stop having exams, don't even have courses, just have endless bullshit sessions. Just let the kids talk and do what they want in college, which probably is so extreme in the late 60s, it wasn't taken seriously, but it seems to be more relevant to today because the kids go to school for different reasons now because they're getting all the information around them in the digital, what I call the chip body. So they actually go to university for social life and all the different aspects of social life.
Yeah.
In other words, a life of bullshit. They do their image management
and,
among their peers.
And the education is a socialization more so than the content-based education.
Right. It's a military. It's like being drafted. Going to education is the modern draft. Kids, parents work hard to get their kids there because supposedly they make the right social connections in university, and everything is geared to saving money to get the kids there or to get good marks and get scholarships. But they must be in the military. It's like if you're an Israeli, you've got to be in the military at some point, right? When you're young, it's
right.
Mandatory. So university education is a modern software draft. Now, here's a new idea, just invented it right now, never thought of it before, but this is what I thought McLuhan was good at, coming up with patterns.
Perfect.
I'm proud of my new pattern.
It's a software draft, basically.
Yeah, it's a software draft, and it's unspoken because it's such a decentralized world since the 70s. It's very hard for anybody to impose anything on anybody. And you're not allowed to impose, and you got to be polite if you even talk about anybody else. You got to be politically correct. So nobody's going to say what's actually happening. There's a draft. It's just a given, which is taking the ground, the culture and its propaganda, and the cultural technologies are the propaganda from Ulul and McLuhan's point of view, and going along with it. So when
–
go ahead.
I was going to say the place where I guess the place that comes closest to explaining the disagreement over the nostalgia here, I mean, is saying Alex says that he has no nostalgia whatsoever for the print era and have advocated educational reform to make it relevant for the digital era. So I guess that's where the misunderstanding is, that like if I was really nostalgic for the print era, I wouldn't be trying to reform it. I would be trying to save it against reform.
Yeah.
So, but I think, you know, that's missing the point of what Blake is saying.
So he has this quote from John Seely Brown and Paul Duguid, 2000, The Social Life of Information. Quote, universities are concerned with the communication of knowledge. So radical innovation in communications technologies inevitably suggests change in universities. Radical innovation, like what the hell? It's so limited. Now, I personally am involved with new scientific breakthroughs and new energy devices. I actually know what the new technology is and what it's going to do.
Yeah, and that's one of the that's one of the functions of a university, not the print era function of a university, but as an incubator for advanced technology, it is one of the main points of a university.
Yes, and I know from what my partner, Dr. Carolyn Dean, and I are doing with our source known as ION, we are going to upset knowledge vastly in what we're doing. Now, no one knows about this technology yet other than our medical applications. But I'm not an idiot. I'm not making claims about something that is a fantasy. I'm making these claims based on personal experience of the technology and what it's going to do and how it works. And so I think that I'm a very valuable media ecologist because I'm dealing with the new technology and the effects it's going to cause. So I'm right on the front lines. Now, why can't people sort of say, okay, we don't know if Bob's lying or not. We know he's a liar. He's been a liar. Why can't we just take the role he's offering? Like I'm pretending to be someone with a new technology. You can look at it that way. And then trying to think about it. Why can't that be done? I don't think scholarship. Well, how does scholarship work in McLuhan? Okay, so they made a big deal out of Elizabeth Eisenstein. I think that was her name. So she goes back to disprove McLuhan, and she does all kinds of scholarly, manuscript, literary research to prove that books, yes, they did change society. What was interesting to me is that McLuhan understood that factual knowledge, factual research in the print-oriented world, did not apply anymore. He used to say that someone who became authority was based on their knowledge. And so if the FBI is after some problem, some drug dealing, they're going to hire some mafia guys to infiltrate. And so as McLuhan said, that you can't be a politician and not have a conflict of interest. And there's all kinds of overlapping environments. So you can't follow the old literate rules, the legislation about having no conflict of interest. Well, it also applies to every other form of knowledge and every other institution. Everybody's so overlapped in the global theater and the global membrane that they even brought in 1947 in the National Security Act, they said in the United States, if you're an intelligence agent, you have the right to lie to the people because you're engaged in activities and no one can know about it for national security reasons. It seems that McLuhan, if you knew these actual aspects of the intelligence world, you could see that McLuhan was addressing that world and making statements based on that, you know, based on understanding the obsolescence of information in many ways, the necessity of secrecy, and what he called management of media environments by the emperors, by the tribal chieftains. He was addressing the dilemma of the head of the CIA.
It is a big dilemma because, this is another one of these confusions where it seems that when the response comes in, like the responses to what Blake Victor said, that they're responding to something else.
Yeah.
And the difference, there's this big difference between, saying that factual knowledge doesn't apply anymore, or is obsolete, or something, or even to say that having an intellectual elite that know what they're talking about, saying that is obsolete is not to say that their knowledge is fake or untrue, or that there is no difference between a true statement and a false statement, or that the truth and real knowledge is not useful. It's just obsolete makes a very different claim about it, or that it doesn't apply anymore. It's completely overwhelmed and puny compared to the force of a new environment that is indifferent to it. That's not to say that facts aren't facts and knowledge isn't knowledge or something. They seem to respond to a much baser accusation.
Yeah. McLuhan said in the 60s that we can see that the medium is a message because we have so many technological turnovers in the 20th century that the average person starts to notice, everything's different here in the 1970s because we got this new computer world coming in. So the technology is sort of affecting my employment potential on this and that. So it became normal awareness, at least by 2000 and the Internet coming in, that people understood that technology was changing their lives more than anything else. So with that general awareness, which is all McLuhan was saying in the 50s and 60s, he was just asking people to look at the dynamic if you bring in television or computers. And he used to get irritated by people calling him a guru or this and that and put him on a pedestal. He thought that what he was pointing out was damn obvious. And he writes in the early 60s that he would go to conferences and spell out the idea that the meeting was a message, and he was puzzled that nobody disagreed with him. So the awareness of change is so obvious to anybody now in 2017 that the real part of McLuhan – no, I don't say the real. The relevant scholarly part of McLuhan, which everybody misses – as Don Thiel said, the problem with Tom Wolfe is that he said McLuhan might be right. The media are affecting our brains. We don't have the neurological science to back it up, though, so we don't know if he's right or not. That really wasn't, Don Thiel pointed out in his book, wasn't what McLuhan was on about. McLuhan was on what was knowable, not the state of our neurology, but how books, painting, sculpture, opera, baseball, sports would change according to a predetermined pattern if you looked at the nature of the media environment. So obviously, yep. You know, Finnegan's Wake is a and the Cantos and Eliot's work are total knee-jerk reactions to the mixed media, movies, radio, and telephones of the teens and 20s. It makes total sense.
Yeah, and all of that literature is a mountain of evidence for the hypothesis. You know, you can't say, like, oh, well, we don't have the double-blind controlled studies to prove it yet in a neurological sense. It's like, yeah, that's the whole point. We are living in a culture now where there's this really narrow definition of what you can use as scientific evidence, where if you just look at the development of the arts over the last few centuries, the pattern screams out.
A pattern that can be used in your practical knowledge, your practical experience in social management of whatever level you're operating on, municipal, state, or federal, or international. I mean, it's practical wisdom. McLuhan retrieved practical wisdom, the use of it, and
Not that there's anything wrong with the double-blind control. That stuff's great, you know? But, like,
but it's puny.
But, I mean, yeah, that comes down to the issue again of just this disagreeing with something else, like some, you know.
Yeah. To bring, a key point, and everybody wondered when they read McLuhan, oh, am I visually biased or am I an acoustic person? Not many people understood that he was talking about the effect of new languages, new technologies on older languages and culture and arts and sciences. That's what people didn't seem to get. And it didn't involve personal points of view, political, religious, ethical. It was environmental effects on culture and technologies. And so anybody can enter that dialogue. People experience culture in all kinds of different ways if they know the ground rules. What I found on the Alex's forum is that people were pretending they had knowledge. They would cite that I did this 40 years ago. I worked for the IBM, and we studied their first mainframe computers, and I even had some inventions to it. This is the very thing that McLuhan is countering. The obsolescence of that kind of experience. His expertise was in noticing how, say, why Monty Python becomes very big in the United States in the 70s. He would look at what's the nature of the content and how does it match the media environment or respond to the media environment of the 70s. That's what he was interested in. Not, and as a matter of fact, when whatever that guy was, Guffman, forget his name, the guy at the Herbert Krugman, at General Electric, you know, in the late 60s, set out to disprove McLuhan, and he tested, analyzed people's brains, measured them in responding to television or newspapers, and he noticed that the brain patterns were different when the person was using different media. Now, looking at the neurological, at the physical body, and he thinks that's what McLuhan's about, and he said, my God, this stuff does alter brain patterns. McLuhan is right. So what did McLuhan say when I have the article, when the New York Times called him up and said, hey, it's pretty good. You've been proven. He says, I'm not interested in scientific proof of what I'm doing. I'm interested in making more discoveries. Let those guys do that, but I don't care what they come up with. That's not what I'm about. That's pretty amazing to an intellectual guy in academia, indifferent to the proving of his, at least the neurological level.
Right. That's supposed to be like one of the best days of your life.
Right.
But that's like your coming out moment when you get to have your not just here's my idea tour, but you're like, you will listen to me now. Tour.
You get to gloat. You get your revenge.
Yeah.
Revenge against the high school bullies that beat you up.
Yeah, instead he's like, quit wasting my time, please.
Yeah. And so so people, if they don't know much about McLuhan, they're going to be puzzled by that. You bring me in or some other knowledgeable person, we say, well, he was interested in the effects on other media, not on our brains. That would be a subset of interest because he eventually got into brain analysis. But even that was 20 years later turned over in mainstream, you know, fad-obsessed science. They reject the brain divisions now, I think. That's what I've heard anyways.
Right.
But that's he would always take whatever was a fad and explain it in his terms. Okay, why are people mapping the different kinds of hemispheres? Because the central nervous system is obsolete. It's been superseded by an externalized central nervous system. You know, so and that's why he was satirical. He could call himself a manipulative satirist, but he also was serious. And it was a scientist, or at least some kind of guy, saying, look, we can make some laws here. And and you know what he said in 1968 in Time magazine, in Newsweek magazine, his New Line newsletter came out. And he said, first off, people are still interested in hardware and the old technology, and so we're going to go along with that, and we're going to try to work with the preference of people for old technology. And then he also said that we want to establish some laws, principles, not sure the word to use, and carve it in stone. So he's redoing Moses, you know, and he was trying to find patterns to guide people in all levels of society and institutions. So this is why he would appear to be frivolous and talk about the latest fad. I mean, he had great statements about streaking, whatever was going on. He had a neat pattern pretty quickly, and he didn't wait around to prove it. You know, to make this scientific studies about whether there was such a thing as streaking. Had streaking ever really happened, you know, outside of the Oscars or something? Is it a public phenomenon? In academia, it's forced to study the nitpicking details in the realm of efficient causality, I guess.
Yeah, well, and they can come up with a lot of interesting stuff, you know? Like, you can zoom in on a topic like that and come up with lots of interesting patterns, but, you know, McLuhan was just going all over. I mean, but that's the thing, is that he was, ultimately, I think of McLuhan was, he was a career-long repudiation of the truism that there's no accounting for taste.
Yeah.
Like he was a scientist of taste, just coming out with the laws of what, at least, or mass taste, at least in the aggregate.
Yeah, that you could notice. You could have enough of a phenomenon happen and spread wide that you could say, oh, there's a trend, there's a preference. And Art, he used to adopt
Wyndham Lewis. What are the mysterious laws of that preference?
Right, and he adopted Wyndham Lewis's definition, or hoik it up, that art was the sign of a colossal preference. And now you had media environments making massive, colossal preferences, and so therefore that was the new art. So the it's almost like the Media College Association has Suzanne Langer, Jocky Lowell, all these other people who sort of did media studies literally. They looked into communications. They didn't even use those words, but and Walter Ong too. They would look at media as if it was a new fact, a new knowledge that society should acknowledge. McLuhan even was flippant about even knowing what he knew and presenting it, because he knew that the mind was a pinhead under global theater conditions. He even satirized his own role. So that makes him more interesting than anybody else in the so-called field of media studies. He's the only one worth noticing, because the other guys come and go. Neil Postman is, you know, old, stale bread now. It doesn't apply to today, even though people, rearview mirror people try to hope. The old nostalgic print guys try to bring in Postman. But there's nothing. You get blogs by amateurs that are more savvy than anything McLuhan wrote, but they don't know how they got there. McLuhan is there as a reminder of how we got to the point where everybody can be an instant McLuhanite.
Right, and well, not only just knowing how you got there, but being able to get there from other places, being able to address other audiences and get them where you are.
Yeah.
You know, people have a very limited ability to sort of shout out their own awareness of where they are, but you know, if they had a way to know how it applied to everybody else's and how it came about, then it wouldn't be so useless.
Okay, so what's wrong with this statement? I tell neophytes who just hear about McLuhan, McLuhan said, you look around at what's happening among you and your buddies and in society and in the economy, and you say, what new technology is happening? And then you look at that new technology and you see if there's some interesting characteristics of it that are different from previous technologies. And then you see if what's going on in society, the different fads and across the board, from Wall Street to hobbies and local communities, and see if there's characteristics in those then that match with the new technology. That's all he said. You're on your own. Just know that technology is altering society. Now, the second point, because everybody would get practical. Like, okay, I teach, I run the baseball team for the kids in the summer leagues. Okay, how, what kind of kids have I got here? How do I teach baseball to them? Are they even interested in baseball? And you look at the round, well, everybody's got their own Web 2.0 broadcasting ability. They can have their own talk shows, eight-year-old people. So maybe they don't want to spend so much time out in the good weather playing physical sports. Maybe they're different. So they would look at it practically. They wouldn't say, what's the New York Times bestseller this week? Oh, look, it's some woman in France. She fucked 500 people, and she's writing about her fucking everybody. And that's the big fad, and it's a big seller.
Right, and defending your interest in that or something.
Yeah, then you go, holy shit, that's pretty immoral. No, you look at why would that kind of topic, which is quite outrageous compared to 50 or 80 years ago, become acceptable, become saleable, and become obsessed with. In other words, you look at the effects of new technology on the old arts and sciences. You hear, oh,
hey, well,
go ahead.
Sorry, just that gets to a point of why all this nonsense is really inappropriate, because it's like, does this group exist to try to help people understand McLuhan? Because having these arguments about
your qualification,
moral position, and defending the existence of an elite or not, or obsolescence, like, see, these are not helping people understand McLuhan.
That's right. I thought that me posting obscure paragraphs from explorations and other stuff that people didn't have access to. When while I was doing it, they actually started to make the explorations available online. I think it is. I have my own copy, so I didn't look into what they're selling. But the point is, there's lots of interesting statements by McLuhan about all kinds of obscure historical media and on this and that, that you need to know about to understand the range of what McLuhan was looking at. It helps you understand his application of Joyce, of Finnegan's Wake. So putting on quotes, I thought would help people. I get accused of copyright infringement, for fuck's sake. You're violating copyright here. I said, well, this is the McLuhan site. It's for them. It's their material. How am I violating copyright? So
exactly. They would rather talk about stuff that's not written by McLuhan that only vaguely mentions him.
Right.
Or
now that's a good
kind of comes up to a similar theme, and they can talk about whether they did a good job of dealing with that theme. They don't even want to talk about McLuhan.
Yeah, good point. Is that I think you can subscribe. Okay, anything on the net that's posted about McLuhan, you'll be notified. I know people have been doing that for 20 years. So I assume Alex Kuskis and a few others have that app. And so you notice any article on McLuhan, the New York Times, or some obscure academic place shows up right away, and Alex posts it. Okay, so they mentioned McLuhan. They're wondering whether McLuhan is relevant or McLuhan's obsolete. So they're just posting the article and not making much interesting commentary on the person. They might say, well, this guy, it did come down to, this guy is way off. I remember Andrew McLuhan getting outraged at some guy wrote something and thought he was applying McLuhan, and from Andrew McLuhan's point of view, this was really ignorant, no knowledge of it. Well, how about let's look at the trend of quoting McLuhan. Why is McLuhan noticed now? Why is he, it's been about 15 years that McLuhan's quoted all the time and referred to. Why can't people get past McLuhan, the Baudrillard, and the other people that moved on? So you would look at the phenomenon of McLuhan quoting that's rampant, especially since this past year of election, and look at that as an effect of something.
Yeah, and there's a big trend that way in there's a big appetite for these articles about so-and-so predicted our world.
Yeah.
So-and-so, and they did the thing about Neil Postman's son did the same thing. I mean, it seemed like these main people, these main participators on this list, like, it seems like they honestly aren't really interested in Marshall McLuhan.
Right.
Like, sorry to say it, but considering the fact that most of the bulk of the McLuhan material, they either have nothing to say about it or they're irritated it's there because it complexifies what they are interested in. You know, the only thing they were really passionately interested in talking about was trying to build this insistence that McLuhan is an ally of not even the left wing, but the mainstream Democratic. And especially when it comes to Postman, like they're trying to do that. Like they were trying to do that more than, you know, Neil Postman's son, the thing he wrote about my dad predicted today, or my dad's work is extra relevant these days. The thing he wrote, it was published in The Guardian, so you can kind of float on an assumption the whole time that he's talking about against Trump. But if you actually read it carefully, he was kind of scrupulously nonpartisan about talking, or bipartisan about how his dad helps you see through both sides or whatever. So he would, like, I'm not trying to include Neil Post, I forget his first name. I'm not trying to include Neil Postman's son in this denunciation. It's these other people that are very offensively trying to make Postman, you know, maybe he's dull or whatever, but he's still useful in terms of people, you know, this crucial knowledge of, and it is a McLuhan-related knowledge somewhat, of how to include the bias, how to not just swallow the content directly, but to include the bias and understand what is added to it and to de-spin it to see what spin is there, both media spin and content spin. And it just seemed like the only thing that really inspired a lot of talk was denouncing you or building this idea that McLuhan and Postman are allies of the mainstream Democratic.
Right. It's almost like, yes, the intelligence agencies knows that political left-right divisions are obsolete, but let the people wallow it and argue and post and complain, you know, from Rush Limbaugh to that Russian guy, Max somebody, who's on the Russian TV, you know, Max Kaiser or something. This range of left-right, and let people continue to categorize politics that way, and the intelligence agencies, who know they're McLuhan, are above it, and let the people be ignorant. Now,
They understand that it's like the left-right is more of a media bias, like a literate versus oral is sort of a shorthand for it or something.
And so the educator, the Alex Kuskuses and the other, David Folgers, get on there and say, okay, we understand the intelligent management of Obama and his advisors about media ecology. They know it. They don't tell the people about it. But they have a detached perspective and are balanced, whereas Trump is obviously a guy who knows nothing about media stuff and is actually disrupting the media ecology and is a threat to everybody. Well, geez, if I look at Trump, which I wasn't following the thing until about the spring of 2016, and Ian said, take a look at Trump, Bob. So I went on and looked at it. And after laughing for 20 minutes, I said, okay, immediately did the McLuhan approach. I said, what is it about Trump that reflects our media technology rate today? So I like to call it Web 2.0. It's the people are bigger than the old media. You're your own broadcaster. You have incredible autonomy. You don't have to listen to anybody else. You can create your own media coverage statements. So I said, okay. So if we've got a society with everybody doing that, why wouldn't the White House, which always has to reflect the president as much as possible, have a president who's equal to that, acts like that, and mirrors back to the public a comforting image? Remember McLuhan said charisma is someone who looks like a lot of other people. So the Hillary and Trump and the others are battling over what's the appropriate charismatic image that make a lot of people think I'm one of them. So Trump comes on yelling and screaming, and I said, that's what I experience every day on the comments in various forms. He is expressing the average person tweeting and yelling and being rude and interrupting and trolling. And I'm going to go into trolling a little later.
And having a fair amount of contempt for the main political actors that they see on TV.
Which is what everybody
tries. That's important, expressing that contempt.
that is so conventional. Trump is such a conventional person, mirroring what most people are yelling about in their commentaries. They're always pointing down the politicians, and they have different solutions they propose, but they all are disgusted with the older, analog, one-way, centralized media institutions, right? This is irrelevant. And they just mock them, and they watch TV to mock these people. So why wouldn't a guy be like everybody else and come out mocking? It is so obvious what he did. Whether he understood what he was doing or not, he was so much of the present that no wonder he won. He was reflecting the back to the
people. And this is the problem, because like what you're saying here is not even something that is necessarily absent from what these people on the McLuhan list would say. It's just that there is a big nostalgia defense complex and moral judgment complex that just severely limit their perception and what they're willing to talk about. Like, just they would, you know, I'm just thinking like they would agree with that, or they would say a similar thing. It would be more loaded and ugly the way they phrased it, but about people wanting to see someone like them on TV, or Martin talks about this, you know, Martin is bothered by the masses' resentment of elites and wanting to become the elites themselves by force without, you know, being elite or something. And, you know, so they, like, get something about that. I mean, you know, it's this idea that, sure, McLuhan knowledge is about understanding that the preferences are created by the media environment, but they still keep this attitude where it's like, but it's totally outrageous and disgusting, of course, what's going on.
Right.
And that's like that's the limit of their analysis.
This is what I want to address. Carol, forget her last name. We did a long session reviewing her book, a very good book she did in 2012 on new media art and all that. She comes on the McLuhan Facebook, and she's a professor, and says, the whole world's gone insane. That's the very fucking thing that McLuhan was trying to correct or teach you so you didn't react that way. And then you have...
parasane. Parasane, not insane. It's a new type of sane.
Parasane, right. So not para-insane, you're saying parasane. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
So everybody on the McLuhan... Most of them, I don't know if there's anybody who was detached about it, other than maybe you and me. Logan, maybe, but Logan didn't comment much. Paul Levinson was sort of detached, but he was using the old categories, and that's easy and actually fails. But I'm willing to discuss it and have him defend his side, and then I'll argue back what I'm saying he's missing and this and that. But they all took it personally. Basically, they all said, I hate Trump and I'm going to vote Hillary, or there's no way Trump can be president. This is not what McLuhan teaches. You do not react that way. You look at the phenomenon like a scientist or a weatherman and say, where are the fronts moving? Where is the hot and cold temperatures moving? And then you look at what other media are doing. And you look at
It's important, because if people out there are desperate for some understanding and they are, you know, for whatever reason, they're less privileged in their mental detachment or something, when they come to McLuhan for wisdom, they're supposed to have chosen wisely and hit the jackpot.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you searched under the right term, my friend. But then instead they would immediately find like, oh, these people, it's just another outpost for this type of person. I'm not going to learn anything here.
Well, you know
That's
what?
A tragedy.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. And, you know, the accusations that I brought my group of supporters on is ridiculous. I never told anybody.
It is ridiculous.
About anybody coming on there. I think I told one person, hey, you're into McLuhan? Come over here. I didn't tell him, you must agree with me and support me. And that's ridiculous. Okay. But the way the form is, that it starts nitpicking at each other, all forms are like that. The tragedy is this forum allowed itself to be a typical forum where everybody starts ganging up on somebody or nitpicking about someone else and insulting each other. I have never seen a forum where that doesn't happen. Maybe on a strict academic classroom forum, you know, where the professor's overseeing and you're trying to get a mark or something, then you don't get rude. but there should be no, there should be a toleration of every form of expression on there, and trying to show whatever the person expressed how, hey, you might be missing the point. How are you reflecting the ground here? What are you noticing in pop music that reflects Trumpism, you know? So
right. None
of that's done.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you're quite the opposite is done, like a suspicion of a kind of a, we don't want to have an alt-McLuhan thing here with people posting kind of random pictures or something that just are, you kind of have to decide it could be relevant or not, and as if there's, you know, a waste of space or something, like,
okay.
I don't know, I mean, sure, if they want to, but the thing is, you can moderate a forum without being rude about it. Whatever.
Okay, I need to stop the recording. I just heard something blink out. Let me just see. And if that happens, the recording has stopped. Let me see. Say something, Brian.
Hello, hello.
Yeah, I think this one has
gone.
So what we're going to do, we're going to stop and come back in, do it again, and start up the recording. Because for some reason, the second phone went out. And what was the last point you were just saying? We're going to begin.
Nothing too specific. Just having a very limited, having the idea that that people are abusing the forum if they're being kind of vague.
Right. Right.
Or
okay.
Just posting a picture or something or a song.
Yeah, because I want to. What is the academic standard that we're trying to reach, and what is the relevance of that? Okay. So you hang up, and I'll hang up, and I'll stop the recording. So you hang up.
Okay.
And I'll call you right back.